Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. Marcia Smoke is a quiet, humble individual who lives in Alderville. When you meet her, she is soft-spoken, listens intently, and chooses her words with great care. Marcia Smoke is also the new Southeast Regional Chief for the Anishinaabeg Nation. Northumberland is part of the area she serves. Smoke is a longtime advocate of Indigenous rights dating back decades. She takes on the pressing issues facing First Nations in her new role, supporting chiefs like Alderville's Tanar Simpson and others. She is also a successful entrepreneur, a knowledge keeper, and a loving great-grandmother. To find out more, have a listen. I am absolutely delighted to have with me today Marcia Smoke, the Southeast Regional Chief for the Anishinaabeg Nation and a member of the Alderville First Nation. Welcome to Consider This Northumberland.
Hello, Robert. It's very nice to be here with you.
Before we go too far, could you explain the role of a regional chief?
Well, it's a new role for me, certainly. And the Anishinaabeg Nation is the oldest political organization in Ontario and can trace its roots back to the Three Fires Council, which is a council that encircles the Great Lakes, goes in across the this invisible border that we call. And it's a council that has been in place for our ancestors for a long, long time. So the Anishinaabeg Nation is based in Ontario. And consists of 39 First Nations from Thunder Bay across the Great Lakes down into southeastern Ontario, all the way down to southwestern Ontario. And we are divided into four areas. One area is Lake Superior, Lake Huron region, southeast region, and the southwest region. And in my particular case, I'm the representative for eight First Nations that span right across south central Ontario from the Ottawa River, where the Algonquins of Pequawkinagon are residing, their territory all the way across central Ontario over to Georgian Bay, up to where you have the Chippewas of Beausoleil First Nation and Moose Deer Point First Nation. So we've got eight communities in there, and my role is to be their voice at the Anishinaabeg Nation.
So how does this compare to someone like Tanar Simpson, who is the chief of Alderville?
Well, Tanar is actually the one that nominated me for this role. He is the... The chiefs are actually the ones that I am accountable to. They are the ones that will set the direction on what they want me to work on. At the same time, I'm a catalyst to bring any details of issues to them that maybe they aren't aware of or haven't been apprised of yet. And so... what I do is I started a process where I can communicate with them daily if I choose, daily if it's needed, weekly, or just as issues come up. But my role is to keep them informed on the work of the Anishinaabeg Nation.
And how does your role relate to the Grand Council?
The Grand Council is the Anishinaabeg Nation. We have a Grand Council Chief who is Linda Dubosky, and she is from Chiking First Nation. We have a Deputy Grand Council Chief who is Chris Plain from the Chippewas of Anjanab First Nation down near Sarnia, Ontario. And then we have the four regional chiefs that have been selected for each of these regions. So we work as the regional chiefs and the Grand Council Chief and the Deputy Grand Council Chief. We work together with other representatives from First Nations as well. Core of what of the focal point for bringing issues forward to the chiefs.
How does this structure compare to traditional structures that you might have had in the past?
Well, the interesting part about the Anishinaabeg Nation is that they have gone through their governance, form of governance, form of traditional governance, and they have created their organization based on the principles of our ancestors and what those traditional forms of government have been in the past. It's something new to me, specific to the Anishinaabeg Nation, but I am familiar with like we do have an opportunity to talk about what our hereditary chiefs process was in the past. We don't have that conversation too often because a lot of people don't understand it, and a lot of people really don't know what that hereditary system existed, how it existed in this particular part of the country. So, but it's there. It's always there among us.
What are the pressing issues in your mind that you hope to address as a regional chief?
Oh, there's I just came from a 3-day session with the Anishinaabeg Nation, and we had briefings on many different issues, anything from health to the child welfare system to mining, anything related to economic development. But the issues that are always on my mind have to do with the lands, have to do with our rights, our treaty rights, and then this whole business about our citizenship. I'm very much supporting any kind of action that will be on the table to address the long time discrepancies that have been in our communities, where some of our members are recognized and some are not, all due to legislation. And so citizenship is a big issue for me. And then mainly some of those core issues that touch the individuals. I've always been one that will walk with the people, will sit and listen to what their concerns are, do what I can do to help people along the way. So they're huge files because our citizen issue has been there since the Indian Act started. A lot of people were stripped of their rights. So we've got a couple good pieces of legislation that will open that door to recognize members who are recognize individuals who whose families or their parents or grandparents were their status was removed by government through enfranchisement. And there's now a piece of legislation that will restore the rights of those individuals and their families and their children. So that's exciting. And then, of course, we have some legislation that's been sitting on the books for a couple of years in progress, and that is to deal with the we call it the second generation cutoff of the women who have been reinstated as a result of legislative changes in 1985. So those are exciting things to come forward in the next, I think that we can make some progress on in the next 3 years.
Just for background, so people understand, is it not true that at one point, if a woman married a non-Indigenous man, that her status was stripped away? Is that what we're talking about here? Those kinds of things? Could you just clarify that a little bit for the audience?
Okay, there were two ways that are prominent in how First Nations lost their status. Okay, so in the women in particular, that was a result of the Indian Act. And yes, if a First Nations woman married a non-Indian or someone who was not, might have been a native person, might have been an Indian person, man, that was non-status. But they would automatically be removed from the Indian registry. So they lost their status. And that law changed in 1985. And the women and their children and their grandchildren were reinstated. But that's the second generation cutoff that we're talking about, because once you reach that, so any of the grandchildren now, their children are not entitled to be registered. So that's what we're hoping to correct. And then the other side of it is on the enfranchisement. The government was active back in well, I would say back during the when World War One, World War Two was on. Okay, so if someone wanted to enlist in the war, they would have to give up their status. And if someone wanted to go to university, they would have to give up their status. If an individual family did not want their children to go to residential school, they would had to give up their status. So we've got a lot of members or a lot of our relatives who are not registered because of enfranchisement. So what happened is, it could be a grandfather, a great grandfather back, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Well, once their children reached the age of 18, they were automatically removed from the registry as well. So none of the children of those who are enfranchised, the whole families were basically taken off the rolls. And so the enfranchisement part of the legislation that is there will reinstate those families, anyone who was subjected to the enfranchisement. So again, that is something that I don't think a lot of people are familiar with, because we don't have that many that are enfranchised. But if you have one family who had, half a dozen children, 8 children, 10 children, they were big families back then it is a significant population. So it's good.
So let's use that as an example. So this issue exists. How does your role then, as the Southeast Regional Chief, allow you to go forward?
Okay, so as I got into my role as I made the decision to look at being a regional chief for the Anishinaabeg Nation for the Southeast, I've been approached many, many times over the years to help people resolve some of their issues or to explain what certain issues that are affecting them and their families. And I'm aware that of all the studies and the commissions that have been established over the years to deal with citizenship. And because of the fact that I've been around for such a long time working in our issues, I know a lot of the people who are heading up these commissions or given the work these to be able to proceed and find a good path where some results can be achieved. And so a good friend of mine headed up the commission to deal with the second generation cutoff. So she provided her report maybe 2 or 3 years ago now. I'm not good on dates these days. Everything just kind of runs in together now when it comes to time. So I knew that she did a report for the government to deal with the second generation cutoff. That has gone through various forms of consultation with First Nations. It's gone through various forms of consultation with government, and they're at a place now where they need to hammer out how it's going to work. So the only ones that are really impatient about it are the ones who don't have their status. The ones, because there are so many issues that are before First Nations in their band offices, that this is something that just it's on people's minds, but there's so many pressing issues. So I follow these the workings of government and First Nations, and I am aware that they're now in a collaborative process to work with some of the provincial and territorial organizations to move this a little bit closer to a conclusion. So I raised that last week. This is how my role play comes into play. I'm aware of it. I'm sure that others at the table at the Anishinaabeg Nation are aware of it as well. But I have the opportunity to be able to say, by the way, citizenship, we need to talk about that. We need to pay some attention to it, because this process is now in place, and we've got to be able to be involved in that, so we make sure that all of our concerns are met, and that these members that are going to be beneficiaries of this legislation are going to be able to achieve the results they want. So I can do it both ways. I can facilitate what I hear from government and bring it to the political table. At the same time, I can communicate with First Nations that I represent and say, by the way, I raised this at the Leadership Council meeting last week, and I believe there's some merit in being involved in this, and I will keep you up to date. So, and then that the First Nation then becomes aware of the that it's there's potential for development here, because maybe they're aware of it, but sometimes you have to push the timelines just as reminders, because you're not going to get pushback from people that want to see good things happen, but it's nice to have that reminder there. And that's where I can be involved, and I can follow the process. How my role ventures into that actual process is yet to be seen, because I've just now raised it. I hope that should I be des the designated person to deal with the question of citizenship, then I will have a more active role with those that are involved in this collaborative process.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me like Chief Taylor Simpson, he is very involved in what's going on in Alderville and the issues directly impacting Alderville, how they're going to get a new framework for voting for council or policing in Alderville or those kinds of sort of grassroots issues in front of the people that he's serving. Whereas it seems to me you're a little bit more out there doing larger picture things, things that are moving on a little bit of a broader scale, and being able to track those and make sure that agenda keeps moving forward. Is that a fair assessment, or have I missed something?
I think that's fair, and it's mainly because there are so many issues that affect people on the ground that I'm sure his text messages are blowing up, his cell phone, his emails, because there's always something going on. And at the same time, he brings to the table something that I am really appreciate, because, and that is the Indian Residential School issue. I have been working on this. My husband was a survivor of three Indian residential schools, and this has been a part of my life, for the last 40 plus years with my husband. But back when, when I first went to Toronto to school as a teenager, the people that I met all had this common denominator of being residential school. So Taner, while I'm living with survivors and among survivors, Taner has the expertise of background as a lawyer, as a researcher in the residential school processes that with government, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, with the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. He has that expertise. So it's really, really nice to be able to, talk to someone in the community who understands. So all that to say that while he's dealing with community issues, he still has that expertise to be called on to work on these broader issues. And as a chief, they come together at tables, whether it's the Anishinaabeg Nation, the Chiefs of Ontario, the Assembly of First Nations. They are up on the issues anyway. He is very familiar with the national issues, but because there's so many, I mean, you can't take them all on. That's why you have other people around, resource people to carry the load, help carry the load.
Let's take a moment to get to know you. If you were meeting someone for the first time, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, I've never been one to talk about my work, my life. I've never been one to need to have to say how great I am or need to show. I guess in a way it's being humble. I have had a lot of experience over the years. I've walked in many different arenas, but I really don't talk about that. It's rare I'll have a photo op taken with somebody important. I may have the photo, but I'm not going to put it on social media. It's just something that I haven't give attention to. So when if I were to introduce myself to someone, I would just say that, hi, I'm Marcia Smoke. I'm First Nations. I'm from Alderville. I've been involved in working with First Nations my whole life, and if people need some help on something, I'm there to be a resource for you. That's how I talk to people. But in my life, I mean, I've held significant roles in many places, and some of the accomplishments I've had have been I've been proud of, but I don't talk about them. People know me, people that like I when I was talking about going to Toronto to school, all of the people that I've come across, we've all had it's I keep saying we all grew up together because we have our paths have crossed throughout the years in the different roles that we have. And those of us who are still around, we still are close to each other. We still respect each other. We're all happy to see each other and have good conversations. But some of those other roles I don't really talk about. They're in my resume or on my LinkedIn social media, but those are places where I feel that I have to put that message there. But day-to-day introductions, I like to sit take a I like to be sitting in the weeds basically not really out there front and center, but I've had my share of front and center opportunities and challenges. So
Were you born in Alderville?
actually only my parents, that generation, were born in Alderville. My generation on down, we were all born in Cobourg, the Cobourg Hospital. So my parents are both from Alderville, and that's where I live today. So
Where did you go to school then?
I went to, boy, my parents moved around a lot. My dad was a 30-year employee of retired from General Motors in Oshawa. So at that time, When he first started working, that was when the 401 was just being built. So he used to have to find his way from this area to Oshawa many times, hitchhiking. No one really had vehicles back then. Eventually, he was able to get his own vehicle, but it was still a challenge because of the price of gas, the price of maintaining your vehicle. So we lived. My first recollection when I went to school is we were living in Coburg, on the bank where the new Home Hardware is situated. There were some houses there, so we lived there. But then we moved out to the Plainville area and lived on a farm there just for a couple years. So I went to school in a little two-room schoolhouse over in Bewdley, which we walked to school every day. There's no such thing as buses. And then from there, then my dad and mom decided to move to Baltimore. And there they bought their home. We lived there right up until, well, I actually moved on from there, but they lived there till my mother passed on to the spirit world in 1985, and my dad left, and the rest of the family all ended up gravitating out to Alderville, which is where he is today, and which is where I am. It's we're in a lovely part of the community, and it's just so grounding to be here. So that's the short version of where I lived in this area. The long version is I moved to Toronto when I was 17 years old. I went to school, I worked over there. I ended up taking my first job to work with First Nations in 1977. And then I never looked back. I never went back and worked in corporate sector again. From there, I went up to Northern Quebec and worked in Val-d'Or, Quebec for 5 years, and back down in the Ottawa area, raised my family there, and then eventually I had a business there that I thought my kids, I built for my kids. Turns out they didn't want it, none of the three of them. So I moved home, and or we moved home, and my kids all followed. So except one, she went a little bit further. She left before us, so she's out in Alberta. But yeah, my life has been kind of a road trip, let's say.
Who are big influences in your life?
Well, there's a few. I think the first person that gave me the direction on what I needed to do was an elder from the Treaty 3 area. His name is Fred Kelly. He was the regional director general in Ontario for Indian Affairs, and that was the first job that I had. And I was always ambivalent about, going working for the government. It's like, do you really want to go there? But they were going through a process of recruiting a lot of First Nations people, and I was one of the ones that was basically headhunted and to go there. And I did work there. I don't deny that I worked for the government. I worked there for 19 months. But when I went there, I had not really thought about what my future would bring. And the advice that I got from Fred Kelly, and I was working directly with him, was that, Marcia, you come here, you're going to be working in the government. You read everything that comes across your desk. You pay attention to what's going on, and then you learn as much as you can, and then you go home and work for the people, work for our people. So I really took that to heart, and that's what I did for the rest of my life. So he's one, and then I've had from there, the next person that played a major impact in my life was Grand Chief Billy Diamond. He was the Grand Chief of the Back then, we knew them as the James Bay Cree in Northern Quebec, who signed the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. That was another turning point in my life because I, we're all young. We're all out in, experiencing new things together, and we didn't really have anyone to show us what to do, especially when all of these people are all went to residential school except me, and so we learned things together. I mean, you learned how to present yourself to government, to the feds, to the province. You learned how to walk in the circles of premiers and prime ministers. And working with Billy Diamond, I had the opportunity to be his representative, or the Grand Council of the Crees in Northern Quebec, their representative on the Constitutional Working Group in Ottawa when the Constitution was being repatriated from England. So during that time, it was an amazing experience, one that I'll never forget. And so it was, we're sitting in rooms. I remember going to meetings with with people who are our leaders today, and people that are like Mary Simon, for instance, our Governor General. She was on the working group with me. We collaborated on a regular basis for during that whole time of the Constitution. We were allies. And so when you've got people that have moved on and gone into those other areas, it gives you a sense of pride. So in my early life, Billy Diamond is the one that taught me, Marcia, because everyone that I recall has taught me a lesson. Like, Fred Kelly, you go and learn everything you can and, work with people. Well, what Billy Diamond taught me was, is Marcia, you're working with the Grand Council here. Don't ever get involved in community politics. You get in, don't, if try someone tries to draw you in, don't get involved in community politics. And I took that to heart too. And I never commented. I never had any kind of conversations with anyone that was wanted to share information about their communities, whether it was a leadership question, whether it was issues in their communities, whether it was relationships. I'm a good listener, but I would never repeat information, or people knew that they had my confidence, and that I just don't repeat things. Everything that I'm aware of is locked and locked up, and I'll take it with me when I'm long gone from here. So, and I think that's one thing that I was taught early in life. And the other thing that Billy Diamond told me was that don't ever burn any bridges, he said, because you have to work with everyone in your lifetime. And you may not appreciate the position that someone is bringing forward. You may not even like the person, but still have to work with the people. And so I've always been able to find that good place to be able to work alongside people. So in the political world, those are the two that really helped me. On the personal side, I would say it was my husband Steve. He was an educator. He was a historian. He was a hunter. He was from the earth. He was always on the it was always about the land. And he learned very early when we got to know each other that, I could be a real fireball. I could really just when I know something and I want to get my point across, I can carry it for a long, long time and get really aggressive about it. But he was always the one that found that place to be able to keep me balanced and bring me back to reality and settle me down and and put some perspective in and listen to other people's opinions. And so he provided that grounding for me, and then so I mean, I've got three people there that have played an incredible influence in my life. And of course I would be remiss if I didn't talk about my parents and my family, but because they're the foundation. They're the ones that provided the our traditional ways, our traditional way of life, our teachings, our ceremonies, our the ways we conduct ourselves, So I mean, there's a that's enough. I felt I mean, I'm always open to learning lessons, and I do learn lessons every day almost, but those are the ones that I'm profoundly appreciative of.
You are also an entrepreneur. You have started multiple business ventures, one being Moccasin Trails, which were on environmentally sustainable projects, and you did work in Ontario, Canada, and farther afield. You also started a travel agency at one point in your life in northern Quebec, Pash Travel, I think it is, which was a very big company. I think in 2009, you were booking something like 4,000 flights a month. Talk a little bit about your entrepreneurial side.
Okay. Well, I've always been one to that wants to be busy, and multitasking is something that I was able to do quite well. And on the business side, I actually started working on my own when I was still in Quebec, when Billy Diamond decided to no longer run for Grand Chief. He retired from that role. He still was busy after that. But at that time, I decided to, well, I didn't know what I was going to do. So I thought, okay, well, I still have to work. I still have to, I'm here in Val-d'Or, and I don't want to be, if I'm going to be here forever, I got to have something to do, or where my next stop is going to be. So I started doing work on with little contracts here and there, where I was able to, work on some files for whether it was First Nations or whether it was for some of the Cree organizations, Cree entities there. And so that was fun. It was working. I was working almost full time, but not from an office, mainly from my home. And I was able to do my work that way, and I actually liked it. And I never went back to working full time anywhere after that, because I kind of got that when we were in, when I was in broadcasting, we used to say you get that broadcasting bug and you can't get away from it. So, but this one was in as a consultant role. And so while I was busy doing that, other opportunities came up, and I decided that I wanted to start a travel agency, because working with the Cree, you were on the road all the time. They didn't have a good, I didn't feel they had good service for the amount of travel they were doing. And so I did a little bit of research on that. And between me and my husband, Stephen Pashagumshkim, we used the first part of his last name. He was always known as Stephen Pash anyway, and his family, their name is Pashagumshkim, but they always, a lot of them shortened it. So we used his name as the name of the company, Pash Travel. Started in 1990, and we ran it as an independent travel agency right through till we decided to retire from that 23 years later. And so through that time, we had a really good opportunity to do other things, and tourism was a big part of it. So back then, there was nothing really going on with tourism. All we had were the odd craft shop, and not much else out there, but we had people that were craftswomen, sewers, seamstresses. We had all kinds of people there that had this talent for doing things, but they had no outlet to, to sell their goods. So I got involved in back then we were called Aboriginal people. I got involved with some people on a national basis that was involved in Aboriginal tourism. And we actually created a national organization called there was two Canadian Native Canadian National Aboriginal Tourism Association, and then from there, Aboriginal Tourism Team Canada. And we took that national organization and were able to bring together people from all over the country to talk about Aboriginal tourism. And I did that under the auspices of PASH Travel. That was my means of being able to have that input. And the big parts about tourism was that we're at a stage where you had the New Agers coming along. They wanted to know about they wanted to wear feathers, they wanted to wear our clothing, they wanted to, they were wearing headbands, and all kinds of things were going on with the New Agers, and then they wanted to know about our culture. They wanted to be involved or e experience a sweat lodge. They wanted to sit in our circles and learn, and to and finally, as tour operators, as those involved in tourism, we basically put the brakes on. We said, okay, our culture is not for sale, and we will not share our culture where it's going to be exploited. So I spent the up until and right up until now, that's where even the citizenship comes in and plays a role, because I will not support anyone who is trying to learn our way of life and be financially take financial I guess the easiest way to say it is to benefit financially off of something that's not theirs. And so I've basically been a watchdog my whole life on cultural appropriation. And so the role at PASH Travel was really significant in being able to follow this. And then there was other companies that we're involved in. So it's always been about who we are as people. And the same thing with Moccasin Trails. Moccasin Trails is a company that is working to with the construction industry. We provide the huge matting, the matting, wood matting that creates platforms for construction sites. And I really hesitated. It took me a long time. It took me about 3 years to really get involved in this, because I was being pulled into it by another person in that industry, and I didn't know what it was. I thought, mats. I'm like everybody else. I think that's what's on your floor. It just stepped through the door, and I couldn't wrap my head around what matting was. And then finally, my brothers told me, because they've been in construction their whole life, and I should have known. I should have just asked them in the first place. But and then once I knew what it was, then I didn't know whether I wanted to be a part of it, because this is around 2012, 2014. And it was a time when pipelines were a major issue. Pipelines were, really having, creating a lot of devastation in territories. It was creating a lot of opposition by First Nations. Others were looking at it as opportunities in our communities. So it was a very controversial issue. And one of the things about the matting, what I was told, is that, okay, well, you've got all these pipeline companies, they need mats to be able to do their work. And I thought, oh, That's another reason why I shouldn't get involved in this because it's pipelines. So, but then I was able to talk to my sister about it, and she's the cultural knowledge keeper, and for the women in our family, and she's the go-to person. And when I realized that these mats are going to be used to protect the environment, then and I had to watch the process for 2 years because I went to a site in Minnesota where mats were put down, and I saw all the work, all the platforms. It was a huge work area. And then I went back a year later on my travel through Leech Lake, Minnesota. I stopped again and I looked at that same site where the work had been done the year before, and all of that vegetation came back and up in its natural state. And that's what the matting did. It protected the plants, the life that was there before it. So that's what gave me the confidence to be able to then go into the matting business. And that's been, again, it's always these things that I'm getting involved in that people have never heard of before. So I've spent the next probably the next 3 to 5 years sharing this information with First Nations on why it's so important to have this. It's to protect the land, and they get it, So yeah, there's been a quite a range of business opportunities there, but yeah, it's and it's fun. It's sometimes you've got to just that's one thing that that's one thing about me. I'm not going to dismiss something just because I don't know what it is. I'm gonna get in there. I'm gonna learn everything I can, do my own research, and find out all the whys, the 5 W's, and I'll make my own decision.
You mentioned earlier that your sister was a knowledge keeper for your family, and I've seen references to you as a knowledge keeper. What is that?
Well, everyone has different roles, and knowledge keeper, if you were to look at some of the organizations out there, some of our political organizations called knowledge keepers as a new name for elders, and elders are our knowledge keepers. We often say that when we lose an elder, we lose a part of our history. They carry so much. And so we've got the titles can mean a variation of things. When I look at the role that my sister plays, okay, she's younger than me, she's our youngest sister. And she knows about the medicines, she knows about the plants, she knows about our ceremonies, she knows how we conduct ourselves in our traditional ways. She was the one that received the teachings from our mother, our mom, that about basket making. I think my mom was the last one who made baskets from Alderville. And she learned sewing from my mother. She learned the crafts, the how to work with leather, how to work with all of these different things. So she's our cultural knowledge keeper when it comes to our way of life. So there's that part of she's a knowledge keeper when it comes to that. She knows more about that than I'll ever know. And all of my sisters and brothers were all taught as we were, as we were young. My dad, as much as he was, trying to make it back and forth to Oshawa every day, they worked shift works, 2 weeks nights, 2 weeks days, and somehow he still managed to be able to take my brothers out. They hunted through the wilderness, and it was a wilderness in Baltimore. There were only four houses on our road back then. Now there's a couple subdivisions there, But he managed to teach them all hunting, fishing, trapping, gathering, and they are the knowledge keepers that and the elders who are teaching the younger generation now. So yeah, so it means different things. Some people look at knowledge keepers as as a really streamlined role, but there's so much out there that we have go-to people when it comes to our some of the work, and when it comes to our rights. The knowledge keeper that I go to is my youngest brother Randall. He is more astute on what our rights are and what the Acts of Parliament mean, what all the laws are. He's the one that if I needed a if I for instance, I had to go to a meeting there when I first was elected as the regional chief, and I had only been on the job for a couple of weeks, and I had this meeting to go to, and no opportunity to connect with the chiefs yet. So the issue that I had to deal with, I finally caught my brother. We were both at my dad's the same day, and I says, "Oh, Randall, by the way," so I have to go to this meeting. This is what it's about. I need the perspective of a hunter. And he was amazing. I went the information that he shared with me, I think I was the only one that had the chance to talk to the harvesters, any harvesters. And so what I was able to bring to the table was something that was real. It was people oriented. It was something that the Minister of Natural Resources was able to relate to. And so the messages resonated there. So we have different people in different roles. He's an elder, recognized elder in our community, but he's a knowledge keeper to me. So it's just what we choose to call each other, other than just little brother.
What is your role as a knowledge keeper, though? What knowledge do you keep?
Well, the knowledge I have is basically on the how life has been, the life journey of First Nations from a historical perspective, right up until present day, and it's all of the issues and challenges, the wins, a lot. I've made a point of keeping up to date on how life has been for First Nations during, during my lifetime, but also the past. And so I think that any of the questions that anyone will come and ask me, I usually have an answer, or know somebody that I can point in the right direction. But I don't like to brag about that, but yeah, I know a lot. And a lot of it started back when I had the opportunity to work with Chief Billy Diamond. So
How would you characterize the path towards reconciliation taking place in Northumberland?
how would I characterize it? Well, I think that I've been fortunate to be able to work on that with my family since moving back home. One thing that that's different from my family than perhaps others who live out here in Alderville is that because we lived off the reserve when my dad was working for so many years, we went to different schools. We made different friends. We had when we were of course I don't remember anybody I went to school with in Coburg, but when at the early stage, but going to school in Bewdley, in Baltimore. Once you get to Baltimore, you go to the middle school at Dale Road. Other schools are brought in, other parts of the population of Northumberland, and then going to high school. in Cobourg. Living in Baltimore was almost like our home base, and we still consider it home because that's where we all grew up. We knew everybody in Baltimore, everybody knew us, and everyone played sports together, different activities, and so we had a larger outreach to population in Northumberland County, especially in this area. But then my dad, when they left the reserve in 1937, his family were down in East Northumberland and lived in Brighton, so he's got people there that he knew, and along the lake shore. So when I moved back home, I just kept to myself, just to get grounded here, figuring out what I was going to do. Then I noticed that there was not a lot of communication with people outside of the community. And I started reaching out to people that I knew that actually were from my world outside, like when I was in Toronto or when I was in Ottawa, who I knew had moved to the Northumberland County, moved to Cobourg, Port Hope area. So I was in contact with them, and then I got invited out to, lunch and, here and there. And then there was a question about, people started to think about residential schools, and then of course with my husband Steve, he was the expert on this, not me. And so we started to develop a network of people that we could share information with, and the network grew bigger and bigger. And so we've got we've been able to work with people that share a true interest in reconciliation, and from an educational perspective, and how do we support? How, and so I think that we take the seeds of that, those interactions, and build on them. And we just did two events yesterday or on the weekend, and one was in Cobourg. I got to share our story with newcomers to Canada. There was a venue where people were brought to learn about First Nations. And I shared with them how, we have the oath that newcomers take to become Canadian citizens has changed to reflect, treaties and Indigenous peoples, and what it was before, and that, this is part of your learning the history of coming to Canada. So, so you've got a group there. And then yesterday, our second time back at Wesleyville, the Friends of Wesleyville invited us to do a cultural day. We did, and people came out, and they got to sit. We took our teepee, our teepee travels. It was put up in Wesleyville. It's still there. We'll get it one of these days or next few days. But people were so amazed to be able to sit in a teepee and hear our knowledge keepers talk about different things, and sit in those sharing circles. And we had some women that came to join us from Curve Lake First Nation that were able to, use their beautiful voices to sing and drum, and so as we continue on with the work to share our messages, it's getting broader and broader. More people are coming out, and now, we've got an event out here in Alderville on September 15th with the Northumberland Arts Council group, and then on September 30th we're going to be in Port Hope. That'll be our third time that we go to Port Hope for September 30th. So we've got the opportunities are starting to become more, and what's really, really positive about it is that our chief here, Tanner Simpson, is making that his door is open to having people come and talk to him or invite him to be involved in events. And he goes. And that's what's really good because now people across Northumberland County see that the door to the chief's office is open and good dialogue could take place and learning experiences and to learn from each other how each other can be helpful. Because I'm sure like on the community side, there's information that he needs to talk to the municipalities about. And again, I'm not getting involved in community politics here, but the door is open. So I think it's growing and it's people are not shying away from talking to residents across Northumberland County and sharing our stories.
Marcia Smoke, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Robert. It's been a real pleasure to join you today, you probably know more about my life than I've shared with many people. Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Marcia Smoke, the Southeast Regional Chief for the Anishinaabeg Nation and a member of the Alderville First Nation. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me. And I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at ConsiderThisNorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.